Then Joseph could not control himself before all who stood before him and cried, "Have everyone go out from me." So there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it. The household of Pharaoh heard of it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come closer to me." And they came closer. And he said, "I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by great deliverance. Now therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and the Lord of all his household and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry up and go to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me the Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not delay. You shall live in the land of Goshen and shall be near me, and you and your children and your children's children and your flocks and herds and all that you have. There I will also provide for you, for there are still 5 years of famine to come. You and your household and all that you have, and you and your household and all that you have would be impoverished. Behold, your eyes see, and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see, that it is my mouth which is speaking to you. Now you must tell my father of all my splendor in Egypt, and of all that you have seen, and you must hurry and bring my father down here.' Then he fell on Benjamin's shoulders and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck, and he kissed all of his brothers and wept on them. And afterwards his brothers talked with him." And that's good enough. Now let's go over to chapter 50. Chapter 50, verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrongs which we did to him?" So they sent a message to Joseph saying, Your father charged before he died, saying, "Thus you shall say to Joseph, 'Please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when he spoke to them. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' But Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive.'" And this is the word of God. Have you ever noticed how many products and services are marketed to us as a means to help gain or exercise control over our lives, as ways to help us control our futures? There's Manulife One mortgages to help you get control over your mortgage and pay it off sooner. Other financial services that are geared to try to help you retire sooner and retire better to control your future. After Christmas, I guarantee that there will be a flood of Jenny Craig-like services to help you get control over your waistline. So Head and Shoulders to help you have control over your flakes. And of course, there's Old Spice to get control over your sweating and who knows what all else. My favorite of late that I'm pretty sure that I saw actually on a National Football League game, you may have heard of it. It's, and I have to put it up because the title of it is so picking long, Garnier Ultra Lift Pro Gravity Defying Cream. That's amazing. So if you put some of it on one side of your face but not on the other, one would lift and the other would come down. I wondered, I wouldn't don't think I could afford it, but if you bought enough to like slather yourself before you preached, could you be in the lotus position and levitate? Because gravity is being defied. Now, the assumption for these behind these advertisements, whether it's a retirement plan or a reduction in waistline or promotion of facial levitation, is that you can have ultimate control of your life. And it's such a lie as a marketing ploy. Because the bottom line is that you might think you've got control over your life, but you don't. You might think that you can wrestle control away from something else, but perhaps you can't. The truth is that we're one careless mistake, one accurate diagnosis, one icy road, one misstep on the stairs, one investment flop, one bad phone call, one concussion away from having our bubble burst and realizing that we are ultimately in control of nothing. That it is God who, in fact, controls everything. Now, as Christians, we read about this in the Bible, and we can read books on the sovereignty of God and have group discussions on it and say to ourselves, yeah, I know that God is in ultimate control of my life and everything else, but I wonder whether you actually believe that, whether I do, whether we really live as if that were true. Or maybe you sang this chorus. I remember singing it in Sunday school opening when I was a little kid. He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands. Do you remember that song? And the verses went on and on. He's got my brothers and my sisters in his hands. He's got my aunts and my uncles. He's got the ants and the Beatles. He's got the Beatles and the some other rock group in his hands. And the verses would go on. And I could always tell how well the teachers were prepared by how many verses were made up in this song. And yet the reality is that we could sing this song forever and make up different words and it would be absolutely true because he has everyone and everything in his hands and in his control. And today I want to look at the life of someone who came to the conclusion that God is in control, that God is sovereign, but coming to that realization was probably the most difficult discovery of his entire life. And you can tell from the text that I read that I'm speaking of Joseph's life. And because if you're tracking on the reading plan, you'll be reading it this week, I'm going to want to refer to his story in a way that will not pretell too much of it, while at the same time giving enough detail so you get how tough an experience it can be to come to understand the sovereignty of God. And some ways that we can perhaps do the same. Now, if you've been following the Grow Up reading plan, good for you. You will have read this last week about those who were called the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And you will discover that there is no end to the twists and turns and the sin and intrigue of these men and their family and all of those with whom they have to do. Reading Genesis is like reading the soap opera digest when you're waiting in the checkout line at the grocery store. This week, you're going to read about the story of Jacob's sons as the story of God's covenant promise to Abraham that he will become a great nation continues to be fulfilled. And if the writer of Genesis was a photographer, it'd be around now that he would switch out lenses from the wide-angle lens to the telephoto lens because chapters 30 to 50 pretty much focus in on the story of Joseph. Now, if you recall from last week's reading, Jacob worked 14 years so that he could marry Rachel, the love of his life. She was the favorite of his two wives, sisters, Leah, who I guess was kind of ugly, and Rachel, who according to the Bible, was quite good looking. And Joseph, though born much later than all of his other brothers who were born to Leah and her maids and Rachel's maid, was nevertheless the first son to be born to his favorite wife, Rachel. Chapter 37, verse 3 says, "Now Jacob loved Joseph more than all his other sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic." The next verse says, "And his brothers saw that their father loved Joseph more than them, so they hated him and could not speak on friendly terms," couldn't say a kind word to him. Now, Joseph may have grown up and did grow up to be a wise leader, but he wasn't necessarily wise as a youth. Because not only did he tattle on his brothers, saying that they did a bad job of looking after dead sheep one day, but he also dreamed about all of them bowing down to him, and then had the audacity to tell about both of those dreams, as if their animosity toward him for tattling and being the favorite was not bad enough. And so you've got hatred and jealousy and foolishly shared dreams filling the minds of Joseph's brothers who are off tending their father's sheep. Jacob sends Joseph to see how his brothers are doing. Last time he tattled that they were doing bad, which wouldn't have impressed them, yet he naively sends him to check again and report back to him. As Joseph leaves and closes the gate to the family farm, he probably doesn't realize it will be the last time he will ever be there. But it begins to roll the tape forward where we see three instances of the sovereignty of God at work in Joseph's life. Perhaps in ways that we have experienced his sovereignty in our lives, but also in ways that we would never wish for in a million years. As Joseph approached the place where his brothers were tending their father's sheep, their hatred of him was expressed, first between one another and then towards him. As he approaches, chapter 37, verse 20, says that they saw him coming and they said, "Now then come, let's kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we'll say to our father that a wild beast devoured him." Reuben, who was the firstborn, the oldest son, stepped in and tried to rescue him, probably thinking he would gain his father's favor by doing that. And then he takes off somewhere, obviously. And his other brothers are around having a meal together, just having some turkey dinner. And Joseph is down in the well, probably crying out for mercy. And some Ishmaelite traders come along and they think, "Man, why would we kill him when we can make money by selling him?" If you have ever been rejected by your family, a member of your family, members of your family, even for a short period of time, you know how painful that can be. The waters of family loyalty that should run really deep turn out to be a puddle. In Vietnam, I know girls whose parents have sold them into prostitution around where I stay. Some whose fathers and brothers and even uncles pimp them out for money. Loot being more important than loyalty. The bottom line being more important than the bloodline. Joseph was slammed by violent rejection by his family. His value broken down from blood value to cash value, and he just went with the value of any other slave that was sold. Now, I'm pretty sure at this time, the last thing that he would think about singing would be, "He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got my brothers and slave traders in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands." Singing that would be only slightly more ludicrous perhaps than saying out loud, "I have just been violently rejected by my family. God must be in total control of my life. This is great." Roll the tape forward to chapter 39. The Ishmaelite traders have sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, the king, or the lead guy of Pharaoh's bodyguards. And Joseph shows great managerial skills there, so that within four verses it says that Potiphar left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him there, he didn't concern himself with anything except what he ate. Total management of the entire home and business of this great political leader. Everything he put his hand to prospered. He just had the golden touch. But then in the last part of the verse, the narrator adds a detail that they just don't add unless there's a reason for it. And he says, "Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance." That means he had the bod and the looks. Okay? One result is that Mrs. Potiphar became extremely interested in Joseph. So intensely that it says that she spoke to him every day, asking him to lie with her. Little action on the side. But based on his honor, on knowing of his God's displeasure, and of the trust that had been put in him by Potiphar himself, he consistently refused. Finally, in her aggression, she grabbed his coat in order to pull him into compromise, and he knew that he must flee from the room, in fact, flee from the house. Unfortunately, even though he kept his character, he lost his coat. And then he lost a whole lot more than that, because the coat remained in her hand as she screamed, falsely accusing him in the Message paraphrase of saying, "Trying to make love to me." Potiphar, he either believed his wife or had to act as if he believed his wife. I don't think he did believe his wife. Because if he did, I mean, he's the chief of the bodyguards. He would know how to break someone's neck really fast. If he believed he was guilty, he would have killed him. Instead, he puts him in the king's prison. One of my friends from the States used to be one of my students and is now a really great leader in a denomination down there. While he was my student and we spent a bunch of time together, his father, who was a very successful pastor at the time, was accused of sexual immorality. The accusation was not only devastating, it was untrue. He was later cleared of all charges by an investigation by the church council as well as by the denomination, but the damage done to his reputation was permanent. He moved to two other churches to try and pastor there, and the lying woman called both of these churches, trying unsuccessfully to be anonymous in order to accuse him afresh. The damage was so excessive that although the accusations were untrue and most people believed that there was just enough doubt in the minds of some that he could no longer pastor well and he had to quit entirely that which God had called him to do. So effective, now forced to do something else. If you were to look at Joseph's life and when he was under Potiphar's world, it's 11 years. But we just don't know how that is divided up. Whether he was 7 years in the home and 4 years in prison, or 4 years in the home or 7 years in prison. But even if he was only in prison for 1 year, he knew that he had been falsely accused of impropriety, of sexual misconduct. And that if he were ever released, that reputation would follow him. The fact that he was innocent wouldn't matter at all. Again, I can't imagine Joseph singing to God about his sovereignty. He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the liars and the victims in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands. Falsely accused of impropriety, But God's still sovereign. Oh, sure, I can see why he wants me behind bars. Makes total sense why I have a slop pot for a toilet and fiends for friends and gruel for grub, of course. Sovereign. The final situation in which the sovereignty of God would be hard to believe in and applaud is in chapter 40. Two of his fellow prisoners have dreams. They come to him. He interprets both of their dreams. The prisoner that Joseph predicted would be released was Pharaoh's cupbearer. In other words, he would have the ear of the leader of the nation. So he had interpreted the cupbearer's dream, which was a huge favor, given him a favorable interpretation that he was going to be released. And then Joseph says to him, "When you get out of here, and you will, please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing that they should have put me in this dungeon. I scratched your back, you scratch mine." But upon the cupbearer's release, it says in chapter 40, verse 32, and it says it two ways, just so you get the impact of it. "Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." It says it double, so you don't make sure you get it. Call it being forgotten after performing a kindness. Being used and then cast away. You know, they're so friendly to you when they want to use your car for their trip, right? Everyone's your friend. Now you've got the car back and it's a mess and the steering wheel is doing something kind of funny. And they ignore you. Don't acknowledge you. They don't call you or answer your texts as if you didn't exist, even after performing a kindness. You lend a bunch of money to someone in need with an arranged payback date. When that date arrives, your phone calls and texts are not returned, and you hear by the grapevine that they have apparently left town, forgotten after performing a kindness. Joseph might have held out for a week or two, hoping, maybe even hoped for a month or two that he would be remembered, but before long he knew he'd been forgotten, left to rot. Again, it'd be really hard to sing that song, wouldn't it? He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the givers and the takers in his hand. He's got the whole world in his hand. Violently rejected by your family, falsely accused of impropriety, forgotten after performing a kindness. These are three situations that would be so difficult to believe that God is sovereign in, that he has control of my life and my world right now. And yet at the end of his story, I want you to notice something, but I need to set it up first. Again, we don't know how long he was in that dungeon. We do know that in chapter 41, Pharaoh had two dreams that were deeply disturbing to him that none of his wise men could interpret. And it was then that the cupbearer remembered, oh yeah, there's a guy in prison who had the ability to interpret a dream. And so they brought him up out of the dungeon. They bring him up. They clean him up. Bring him before Pharaoh. He interprets the dreams. And Pharaoh is over the moon impressed to the point where, long story short, Joseph becomes the second in command in the entire kingdom. Then there's a gap. At least 7 years go by. And Jacob, Joseph's father, sends Joseph's brothers to Egypt to buy food because there was a famine in all of the land. And after, which is what we read, after Joseph reveals himself to them for who he really was, notice these remarkable statements that Joseph makes about the sovereignty of God. In chapter 45, verse 5, he says to his brothers, "And do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, because God sent me ahead to preserve your life." Wow. In verse 7, he says, And God sent me here before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And then in chapter 50, which we read, Jacob has died, and Joseph's brothers are afraid that the only reason why they are not dead is because his father has stayed his hand of vengeance. They become afraid, and yet Joseph says in verses 19 and 20 of chapter 50, "Don't be afraid, am I in God's place?" In other words, I'm not going to judge you. "And as for you, you meant it as evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve the life of many people." Now, it might be easy for us to read these things and think, of course he's willing to extol the sovereignty of God in his life right now. He's second in command in Egypt, the greatest nation at the time, and they've got food and they're selling and they're making money. Who wouldn't say, "Yes, God is sovereign and he's put me here"? And yet what Joseph is referring to when he's talking about the sovereignty of God here, it's not just the destination, but the trip. All of the downs, and now the up, was an expression, all of it was an expression of the sovereignty of God. How could he do that? How could he say that? In the last couple of minutes that we have to think about this, I want us to notice five principles that come out of the way the story is told that may help us to understand and accept God's sovereignty even when it's tough to do. The first principle may be the most difficult one to grasp, although I'm not sure any of them are that easy, and it is this: admit that God's sovereign plans encompass a larger scope than your limited world. Admit that God's sovereign plans encompass a broader scope than your limited world. Remember back in Genesis chapter 12, God made a promise to Abraham that he would make him into a great nation. And the soap opera of that happening slowly unfolds through faithfulness and great evil and all kinds of other things. But God knew before Joseph was ever born that a famine was going to be in the land. A famine for a length of time and with a scope of devastation that could wipe out his slowly forming covenant nation. And so Joseph sent to his brothers who sold him into slavery. In a nation which, through great ups and downs, Joseph would attain the power to have access to the food so that this budding nation that God had promised to Abraham could actually live, whereas they would have been starved into extinction. Here again, Joseph's words from chapter 45, verse 7. "And God sent me here before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God." And the people preserved by Joseph's journey through lows and to this high position would form the nation that God promised to Abraham because he is a covenant-keeping God. Did Joseph know all of this while being rejected by his family, while being falsely accused of impropriety, while being forgotten after showing a favor? Probably not. But retrospect shows him and shows us that neither one of us are at the center of the universe. God is. And that God's plans encompass a far larger scope than any of our limited worlds do. And what that means is that we must work hard sometimes and pray fervently sometimes to trust him and his ultimate plans that we have the honor of being involved in. And that's just tough work. Second principle is this: God's sovereign timing to accomplish his purposes is impeccable. God's sovereign timing to accomplish His purposes is impeccable. And the story is packed with examples. In chapter 37, Joseph goes to where his brothers are to be tending sheep. They're not there. But at just the right time, a man appears to him to show him where they really are. That's perfect timing. Joseph is thrown down the well, and as his brothers are thinking about murdering him, along come some Ishmaelite traders who are willing to buy him. That's perfect timing. His older brother Reuben is planning and scheming to rescue him out of the well, but God does not want him out of the well. He wants him in Egypt. So he's gone when he gets there. Perfect timing. Pharaoh's cupbearer remembers Joseph's ability to interpret dreams just at the time when Pharaoh was most desperate. That's perfect timing. God establishes Joseph and then has Jacob, his father, send his brothers to Egypt to buy grain just at the time when Joseph had the greatest power to give them food, and on a day when he happened to be there watching who was coming. Perfect timing. God's sovereign timing to accomplish His purposes is impeccable. There have been numerous times when I've questioned things that God that has happened, and in addition to asking why, sometimes we ask why now. And frankly, I haven't got any answers back on that one. All that I know for sure is that the Scriptures paint a picture of God whose timing is perfect to work out His plans. We may never understand it, but it's His perfect timing for His plans, and His plans rule supreme over ours. The third principle to help us not just understand but appreciate God's sovereignty is this. God may bless you as a part of your participation in His sovereign plans. He may bless you as a part of it. When Joseph is sold into Potiphar's house, chapter 39, verse 2 says, "And the Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man." Blessing. Chapter 41, after Joseph interprets Pharaoh's dreams, Pharaoh says to him in verse 39, "Since God has informed you of all of this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and according to my command, all the people will do homage to you. Only in the throne will I be greater than you." God may bless you as a part of being a part of His sovereign plan in good circumstances, but also in horrible ones. It's easy to see that, oh yeah, God is blessing me as a part of His sovereign plan when He's head of Potiphar's house, when He's second in the kingdom. But chapter 39 describes His time in the prison this way, by saying that the Lord gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. That's a blessing. Two verses later, that whatever Joseph did, the Lord made him to prosper in a prison. God is sovereign, and in His sovereign control of the world, yours and mine, He may bless you apart as a part of those plans, even in the worst of circumstances. So keep your eyes open for it, because if you don't, you just might miss it. Case in point is the fourth principle. I just wanted to separate it out because I thought it needed to be. God may provide a gracious reprieve from the difficulty that you suffer as being a part of His plan. God may provide for you a joyous reprieve from the difficulty that you may suffer. While Joseph was serving Pharaoh, in fact, shortly after he began, he was given an Egyptian wife named Asenath. In chapter 41, she bore him two sons. He named the first one Manasseh, meaning making to forget. And in verse 51, he explains why he named his son Manasseh by saying this: God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. What had God done? In his sovereignty, he had given Joseph a gracious reprieve from all that he had suffered, all the painful memories that haunted him, even though he was now comfortable and successful and safe. They came in the form of the joy of a child, the smell of a newborn, the laughter of a baby playing peekaboo that the boy never tires of, the promise of actually having a family of his own while his own family rejected him. God, as a reprieve from the suffering that you incur being a part of his plan, may in fact give you a gift like that. You got to watch for it, because you just might miss it. And the final principle from this story that helps us, hopefully helps us, understand and accept God's sovereignty is this: anticipate God's presence with you in places where you wouldn't even think he would be. I said before that I'm unsure how much of Joseph's 11 years under Potiphar's world were spent in prison. But the last place that you would expect the presence of God to be would be with us in the darkness and dankness and rats and stink of a dungeon. And yet verse 39, or chapter 39, verse 21 says about Joseph being thrown in prison, but the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him. Two verses later, the chief jailer didn't supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And Joseph's story shows us that God is present with us today, even in places and circumstances where you would think he would never be. So watch for him, or you may miss him there. Now, the sovereignty of God can seem pretty abstract when we discuss it academically, or when God's blessing is being showered upon our lives. It's when the waters wash over the decks of our life and threaten to take us off the boat that we slam into what we previously ignored or treated abstractly, that our broken, tattered, fear-filled, lonely, disease-touched lives are still in his hands. And it is then that you keenly need him to bless you in his sovereign plan, or show you how he has, to give you a joyous reprieve, or show you one that you may have missed, and to show you and help you realize his presence with you, or see that he has been there the whole time. Now, if this describes you, we move the congregational prayer to the end of the service for you, to give you opportunity, either alone or with a brother or sister, to ask God as the sovereign Lord to reveal a blessing to you that you may not have seen, or to give you one. To give you a joyous reprieve from the toughness of it, or show you one he's already given. To make his loving presence known to you today. If I have described you, why don't you come and receive prayer, offer prayer, as Peter comes and we sing together.